session number 11214, reel 1.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Colonel?
I was born on January the 28th, 1898, at Clifton Vicarage, near Ashburn, in Derbyshire. And my father was the vicar there. My mother was conveniently the squire's daughter. That worked all right. And I had a brother about 3 years later, and a sister a few more years later. They are now both dead. The brother, unfortunately, died when he was about 11 at the preparatory school. I went to a small school in Ashbourne in Derbyshire, and then to the what is officially called the Oxford Preparatory School, now more or less known as the Dragon School in Oxford. And that went on to about 1912.
What kind of education were you getting at the preparatory school?
Primarily classical, I think. It was one's memory is practically all Greek and Latin. There were other things as well, but I mean, French was stupid in a way because nobody taught French who'd ever been in France. And that ran for practically all schools, I think, at that time. And the target was always scholarships at public schools. That particular private school aimed at Winchester primarily, and others secondarily. Well, in due course, I was put in for a scholarship at Winchester, which I did not get. And one of the reasons was that there were two of us. You used to go to Winchester or wherever you're trying to get a scholarship. Two of us, Jourdain and de Selincourt. These are the two boys. We were examined by ourselves, and later in the sort of program, we were introduced to the French schoolmaster. I mean, the master who taught French at the school. He read out a piece in French and asked us to write a précis of it. We handed in blank sheets of paper for the very good reason we'd never heard a Frenchman speak before. I only mention that as part of the idiocy of part of the educational system. Right. I was then ticked off for not getting a scholarship, and I was put in for another one at Marlborough. And again, mainly classical scholarship, which I got. And in due course, I went to Marlborough. I was only there really about 3 years or something like that, because while I was there, the First War started.
You went in 1912 then, after your prep school?
That's right.
What was life like at Marlborough?
I nearly said bloody awful. I don't know whether I want to say that or not. It was so crude and so rough, if you like, and the food and all that was atrocious. The accommodation was quite good. And curiously enough, the one thing you never had to do was to clean your own shoes. Everything else was did that, but they didn't make you do that. I've not been there once since, and I'm not sure if it's altered very much. I know one shouldn't say that, but, I mean, one feels that about it. The food, of course, the wicked thing was, I think, the food was so atrocious.
What was it like? What type of food was it that was so bad?
Boiled beef and carrots, basically, that sort of thing. But the proof was, A, that in the mornings, for breakfast time, practically the whole school, there were some outhouses of mine, came in for breakfast in one place, one large hall. It was worthwhile local bakers to come up and sell butter and rolls every day. And you spent any pocket money you had on food, going out and getting food. However, that's rather trivial, but it is a fact.
Was it that the food was badly cooked, or was it bad quality, or was it just monotonous?
No, it was boring, I suppose. I imagine it was healthy, and as I say, boiled beef and carrots, very little roast stuff, distinctly unappetizing, to the extent that people spent a great deal of their pocket money on going to, I suppose you'd call them cafes now in the town, particularly in the afternoon, and having a meal there.
What about the sleeping arrangements, the dormitories? What were they like?
The dormitories had about a dozen people in them. They were, I suppose, quite all right for their time. Wash basins were in the middle of the room. I don't think they had taps. I mean, hot water was brought in. It was all rather crude. I don't think one needs so much more than that. The only thing that was modern, even then, were the washing facilities after games down in the basements, which apparently had only been put in at the most a year or two before. I mean, the rest of the place was anything half a century before. But the after games washing facilities were very good. And that, I suppose, is really how one kept clean. Because I can't remember how you had a bath any other way, but there must have been other, rather simple baths. I think there were, you know, baths with hot water poured into them. But then, it was an uncomfortable place.
What was a typical day's routine like? If you could get, what time from when you got up?
I'm trying to think. Well, sometimes in the summer, I think there may have been some school before breakfast. Then ordinary schooling in the for the morning, and then yes.
How were the lessons taught? What sort of teaching methods did they employ at that time?
It's very hard to describe. You usually, I mean, I can only remember the end bit. I mean, the last sixth form stuff, which was really mainly Latin and Greek. But what it did boil down to is that by the time one was getting near the top of the school, you were doing nothing but Latin and Greek, and practically nothing else. I mean, very little mathematics, very little history, and so on. And, for instance, on Sundays, you had the pleasure of going into school at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoons for a divinity lesson. But the divinity lessons usually consisted of chapters of the New Testament in Greek, and it became another Greek lesson. And the man who took it in my time was subsequently Bishop of Bath and Wells. But he did the same thing there or not, I don't know. But that was the usual setup. Everything depended on the classics. There was a modern side, which I really knew nothing about, but it wasn't very big.
Did you enjoy the schooling? I mean,
no.
You?
Quite definitely no. Because, I am no good at games, and rarely, I imagine, in practically all schools, it's the people who are good at games have far and away the best time. Not necessarily cost and so on, but they were considered the people who mattered. And I never, I was never any good at games, and I didn't like it. And I didn't really like being at school. Right.
Were you lonely at all? I mean, did you?
Yes, I think so. One had occasional friends and so forth, but the conditions of living were so unpleasant. And you never thought of complaining to your parents about it, any more than your parents would have thought of complaining to the school about it.
Was there any bullying at that time?
Oh, yes, a certain amount, but usually individuals against other individuals. And the accommodation was, in the daytime, I mean, the dormitories were all right, but the accommodation in the daytime in that school, for about half the school, was in one large, you can only call it a shed, an enormous great room, just like this thing, expanded by about 10 or where you lived, you had a desk there, and that was your home. Anyway, I don't want to overemphasize that. Yes?
What impact did the declaration of war, you've been there 2 years when the war broke out, what impact did that have on the school?
I think very soon, a certain number of people there was an OTC, the people who, and we were all in the OTC, I think, the people who were of proper age almost went straight off. Though some, quite legitimately, stayed back to get scholarships at the universities and then go to the war. Right. I actually tried to get into Sandhurst and did in 1915, I think. And I'm 2 years older than I'm 2 years older than the year in any given year. You see, so I was 17 then.
Now you said you were all in the OTC. Can I just ask you about that? What were the OTC activities before and after the decade?
Some drill and a field day, probably once a year at Wellington or somewhere like that. I don't know in the least what it was about, and didn't care very much either. But it was voluntary, which means that everybody belonged to it.
And it wasn't important. Did it seem to be an important part of school life? And
no. So I don't know whether it was a hangover from the South African War or what. But, I mean, Marlborough was not a military school like Wellington and so forth, and yet it had this OTC to which, practically, if not actually, everybody belonged.
And you didn't have you don't sound as if you had, at that time, a particular interest in it yourself.
No, I thought at that time I was going to Oxford or Cambridge, wherever they were, and beyond that, possibly something called the civil service. I don't know what that was. My father, you see, was a parson, but a very considerable ornithologist of some note. And he was, like all those kind of people, really fairly withdrawn in their own world. And they never, or I say they, I keep on saying they, but they never discussed things like one's future or really what was happening at school. And I suppose it was part of the ethic. You didn't complain to your parents about what a bloody awful time you were having at school. And you didn't. So the war was, in a way, a great relief.
Were you aware of people joining up early and things like that when the war broke out? Did any of the boys from the school do that?
How do you mean joining up
early? Joining up underaged.
A certain number did. You see, we all thought this was a great adventure. And we were going to get into it by hook or by crook. And I did make some reference to my parents, and the answer was, I think very sensibly, if you're going to do that, you've got to get a regular commission. Because they all thought the war would last a short time and you'd be in the army after the war. You see, and that was that. They didn't realise that you had not much hope of being alive after the war. Anyhow, that's what happened. So I had to go to Sandhurst.
So that was your parents' advice?
That's my parents' advice.
Did the OTC activities become more important after the declaration of war, would you say?
I don't really remember. I don't think it simply increased the amount of route marching. That's really all. There was no theoretical discussion of any kind. I mean, no classes or anything like that.
Had you learned how to shoot? Rifle shooting?
I don't think I did. I carried a rifle, and my God, a rifle was a heavy. It was about twice its weight for people who were a bit older. No, because there was very little, because there wasn't a rifle range there, or if there was, I don't know where it was. They mostly had to go to somewhere on Salisbury Plain, and it was really for the people who had good shots. Because, I mean, there was a rifle team, of course. But
so, how did you go about getting into Sandhurst, or who sorted that for you? I mean.
Well, there was an examination still, and one put in for the examination. One was put in for the examination. I passed the examination.
What sort of subject was it dwelling on, the exam?
Reading, writing and arithmetic, and Greek and Latin. And I got what's called a prize cadetship on Greek. I mean, I got a very, very good marks for Greek, if you please, in time of war, going into Sandhurst. And a prize cadetship had nothing to do with one's military ability. It's simply like a scholarship. Your parents didn't have to pay for you being at Sandhurst. Not that that was any great bother, because when I got to Sandhurst, which was in the autumn of 1915, perhaps at least 100 of us turned up, and maybe 200. And the next day, another 200 turned up who'd failed the examination. And we were at Sandhurst for an indefinite period. We did not learn anything theoretically worth mentioning. We simply learnt how to be good private soldiers, which, of course, is a thing we'd not learnt before. Instant obedience, and among other things, changing into gym kit in 5 minutes, and changing back from gym kit into uniform in 10 minutes, a lot of things like that. And no specific program, and no specific period for your stay at Sandhurst. This large number of people came in the autumn of 1915, and then every month, a certain number passed out, and the number that passed out was more or less geared to the casualties in France. So, I mean, at first, there wasn't very much. Then we began to feel the effects of the Battle of Loos, which gingered things up a bit. And I think that's what affected my particular slot. I was there for 5 months, and the sergeant said, you will be commissioned next month. You'd learnt nothing except how to obey, which was probably very necessary.
So where were you staying at Sandhurst? What accommodation? Was it overcrowded?
No, it was very good. I'll say that. I mean, I had a room once over. You had a bandman, I suppose, very old, elderly gentleman, who looked after everything except your rifle. They were not allowed to do that. And the officers were mostly disappointed chaps, because there were good regular officers who were there in August 1914 and had not been allowed to go to the front. They'd got to stay at Sandhurst, and by now, which is the beginning of 16, some of them were still there, and they didn't like it, of course. They weren't particularly interested in us. We became very good private soldiers. I mean, we drilled pretty well. And then one fine day, we were officers.
So you had a lot of concentration was on ordinary drill.
Yes.
How did you take to drill?
Oh, it was just a necessary part of life, like going to the laboratory or anything else. I mean,
did you understand? Did you find it boring? Or
I don't know. I suppose there's a certain satisfaction in drilling well. By drilling, I mean sloping arms and presenting arms and things like that. In fairly large numbers. The officers, who, as I say, were mostly rather dismayed, not unnaturally, because they had not been able to get to the war by then, they weren't particularly interested in us. I think they gave certain lectures on military law and one, two things like that. But primarily, we were there to learn how to obey pretty smartly and pass that on to the soldiery later on.
Is this where you were taught proper rifle shooting? Do you remember?
There was a certain amount of firing on the range, but not very much. Difficult to organise for these large numbers.
What about bayonet fighting, that sort of thing?
Not really. I think that was occasionally later on, actually in the army, but not much, in any case.
Were you given any chance to command a body of men in the sense of taking them through drill?
No, not unless one, which I was not, and became an NCO. There were a certain number of NCOs, and they had that function to a certain extent. And there were people called under-officers who were better still.
Were you taught any tactics, either theoretical or practical?
I suppose so, but I don't remember it, which may be quite true, because there wasn't much time for it. I mean, there was all this business of smart drill and that kind of thing, and bandit fighting, etc., etc. And then this sudden notification, you're going to be commissioned, we'll say, in a month's time. And then you had to think what regiment you're going into. And I had never thought. One was sort of very detached, because before 1914, I had no idea of going into the army. And so I wasn't bothered about any particular regiment, so I had to think quickly. I had one uncle in the Connaught Rangers, one in the Lower North Lancashire Regiment, and we lived in Berkshire. And I put those three regiments down. Connaught Rangers came up, because there wasn't any great demand for Irish regiments from them. And that, as far as I was concerned, was all right. And on January the 26th, 1916, I appeared in the London Gazette as second lieutenant. I left Sandhurst. I sent a telegram to the commanding officer of the Connaught Rangers in Kinsale. Can I have a week's leave, or a fortnight's leave, or something? They wired back and said, you can have 3 days. Report next Tuesday, or something like that. And then I turned up as green as they make them, of course.
Were you aware then of your greenness?
More or less, because I turned up, it's half greenness. I turned up at Kinsale, which is where they were, complete with sword. I changed my cap badge about 3 times on the way there from a Sandhurst one to a Connaught Rangers one, because I wasn't quite sure whether I could wear a Connaught Rangers one or not then. By the time I got there, I decided I'd better have a Connaught Rangers one. I think it was just as well I did, otherwise I'd have a rough time. And right, I had the bloody sword, and I went to the barracks, which was a very ancient building with 2 or 3 stories. I went upstairs, and a very decent mess corporal said, if I were you, sir, I'd take that sword off. It might be very awkward if you go in the officer's mess with a sword on. I was learning things like that all the time, very green, but learning at a rate of knots. And very soon, finding life rather different, because what I call the First Irish War was on then. We were going round.
I'm interested in that. Yeah. So you joined, this was the 3rd Battalion.
That's
you were
right.
Joining.
Kinsale.
What was your reception like from the other officers? Did they make you welcome?
Extremely nice. And I say that as an Englishman. But no, apart from the fact that I had an uncle who was in that regiment, but by that time was out in Gallipoli. I never saw him for a long time. I didn't even ask him if I could go into that regiment. And I've never regretted that, going into that Irish regiment, which appeared to be about officers 99% Church of England, NCOs about 50% Church of England, 50% Roman Catholic, and private soldiers about 99% Roman Catholic. I mean, it's a reduction ad absurdum, but it was rather like that. I never felt the slightest anti-Protestant feeling at all. There were quite a number of us who were not Roman Catholics, but it was essentially a Roman Catholic regiment. And the only compulsory thing at that time was that everybody, had to go to the service at the Roman Catholic Church in Kinsale on Patrick's Day. But otherwise, it was perfectly genuinely pleasant.
How did you have an interview with the commanding officer? Did he brief you at all?
No. He was a nice old gentleman. I think he was a militia, that is, Special Reserve colonel, called Digan. He never seemed to come out of the order room. I had to report to him, of course, when I joined. And after various experiences, and only 6 months or so, I went and say goodbye to him because I was going to the front. And this is a long story. I mean, he turns up again in France later on, never mind. But that's all. I mean, he was a nice man, I think, but one never saw much of people. The thing we were doing, simple things, rifle drill, route marches and so forth.
What company were you put on in? What company of the battalion?
I don't remember. They were lettered companies, I think. I can't remember. There were quite a lot of them, of course. But
so what were your duties as a young second lieutenant?
Taking simple rifle drill parade, drill parade, drill parade, drill parade, drill parade. And then, like all regular subalterns, I think, he was sent on a signalling course. Before that, I was laid off under a lance corporal to do flag signalling, which included semaphore as well as Morse. And that was fairly grim. I mean, because, you know, flag signalling can make your hands feel pretty sore. At any rate, he was a decent chap, a lance corporal, and I was under him for, say, a month or 2 months or something like that, and I did learn what I'll call elementary signalling, after which, like all, I think, regular subalterns, I was sent to a signalling course at the Curragh.
Did you have difficulty learning? Was that Morse you'd be learning?
Morse and semaphore.
And did you have difficulty learning it, or did you seem to come naturally?
Morse certainly came naturally, because one had a certain interest in electrical things. There were elementary electrical things then. Yes, I must have liked it, because, of course, it affected my subsequent career quite a lot. While this was going on, this sort of first Irish war in the provinces was also going on, and we were doing long route marches to go and arrest people, goodness knows where, and that kind
of
thing.
What was the trouble? Could you give me the background to this, then? Was this as a result of the rebellion?
Yes, this is the Easter Rising in 1916, led to a considerable disturbance all over Ireland. That's really what it was. Mainly, all the heavy stuff was in Dublin. But you got curious things like, you were told to go out tomorrow night with a constable of the RIC to go and arrest some chap in a farm about 10 miles over there, and you'd go out as a second lieutenant with a certain number of men, a platoon, march miles and miles and miles, usually in a circle so as not to alarm the people who you're going to arrest, and try and find the man and arrest him. I can only remember doing it once and then getting to the house in some remote place and then wondering what one did next, because one was told he lived in that house there, you see. And I can remember to this day solemnly going up to the front door and saying, "I demand entrance in the name of the king." Nobody took the slightest notice, of course. Eventually we opened the door and went in, no sign of anybody downstairs. Cut a long story short, we went upstairs and found a wake or something in progress over somebody who was dying, and the whole of the family were surrounding round the bed. I didn't know what to do there, so I rather timidly lifted up a corner of the mattress to see if there were any rifles underneath. I didn't see any rifles underneath, and I probably shouldn't, because they were about there or somewhere like that. any rate, I went away again, and we all marched back, and then I got ticked off for not arresting everybody. And it was all rather like that, which in a sense was slightly comic opera. Well, then, before we went right off to the west of Ireland, then I suddenly got sent to the Curragh for a signalling course.
So that was one. You don't remember any of the other?
No, I don't. There wasn't much of it. There wasn't much of it. There was no ill feeling, as far as I can remember.
No ill feeling against the regiment or against...
No, not like later on.
Did you have to take any precautions when you went out, on your own, for instance? Or?
No, you could usually get hold of a horse very easily, go riding about round Kinsale, and never think twice about anything of that sort.
What about, how were you taking to the art of command, so to speak? Actually controlling...
I nearly said in a supercilious way it was natural. No, it was natural, as a matter of fact. I mean, in the sense, you were accepted in the first place by the soldiers. That wouldn't necessarily be the case now. Wouldn't necessarily. But you were. I mean, I, to some extent, I was a foreigner. It's true that I had a relative in the regiment somewhere, but most of them didn't know that. I never had any difficulties at all, either there or in France.
How did you get on with the men? What did you think of the other ranks, the privates?
I suppose one should be honest and say that was, in a way, in those days, no concern of mine. What you had to be was fair in whatever you were doing. I mean, punishment or extra work or something of that sort. And one wasn't there very long, but one was there for 6 months. Many things happened. I mean, like this, going to arrest this man and things of that sort. And the place was in a disturbed condition. I mean, there'd been the row in Dublin, and it was spreading around the country. But nothing very serious happened. We'd go out into the west of Ireland, and nobody, there was never any fight or anything like that. And you were everlastingly marching. My goodness, you were all marching, of course. I mean, infantry, soldiers, officers, and so on in those days did march. There wasn't any question of getting a horse, let alone motor cars. You occasionally got the company commander would sometimes let you have his horse for part of the route march, which got you off your feet.
How did you get on with the NCOs that you worked with?
Well, again, they were about 50%. I mean, 50% English, 50% British, like 50% Irish. They were quite satisfactory. I think the acceptance of officers and so on seemed to be an understood thing. One never had any feeling of resentment or something. Why should a small boy like this come in and run the show for us? I think primarily that. One didn't feel it oneself in those days. I suppose you were sufficiently smug to think that was your natural place.
Were they of assistance when you first got there, the NCOs, in sort of keeping you, like the corporal who warned you about the sword? Did that sort of, was that quite common?
The batmen were all old, very old soldiers who were not going to go to France, so they kept as batmen there. They were the chaps. My batman told me exactly what I would wear tomorrow morning. I mean, I don't know whether we had battle dress, I don't think we did, but various things of that sort. I didn't even read orders. The batman read the orders. The batman pushed me around and told me exactly what to do and what not to do. And that seemed to work very well. The NCOs, for signalling, which were the only one I was specifically concerned with was signalling, they laid off a lance corporal to take me every day of the week for some weeks to learn signalling before going to a course at the Curragh.